From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The survivors of rape and other gender-based violence are the silent victims of this war.
Estimo il bisso full independent.
Today, an exclusive interview with Kirsty Sword Gushmau, a former underground resistance activist, and her husband, Shanana Gushmau, the leader of East Timor. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As the standoff over a collision between a U.S. spy plane and a Chinese fighter jet enters its fourth day, Chinese President Jiang Zemin demanded an American apology and said that Washington should take full responsibility for the accident. President Zemin also demanded yesterday that the U.S. end its surveillance flights off China's coast. But Secretary of State Colin Powell said that Washington had no intention of apologizing and rejected Chinese accusations that the collision was its fault. A Pentagon spokesman said that the U.S. was unlikely to stop the flights. U.S. officials are accusing China of examining the plane, despite insisting that they have no right to do so. China says it has every right to examine the plane as it entered its airspace without permission. The Pentagon itself has often rejected similar appeals from other countries. For example, when a defecting Soviet pilot flew a fighter jet to Japan in 1976, American intelligence officials, despite Soviet protests, spent 9 weeks taking it apart before sending the plane back to Moscow in packing crates. Meanwhile, China allowed U.S. diplomats to see the crew for the first time yesterday. Japanese mistrust of the U.S. military is also on the rise after a U.S. nuclear submarine made an unannounced port call in Japan. The incident, which the U.S. Navy blamed on an administrative error, was the first ever violation of a pact that requires U.S. military authorities to give 24-hour advance notice before the arrival of a nuclear-powered sub in a Japanese port. The incident comes at a time when many Japanese are angry over what they see as the arrogance of the U.S. military, particularly after a U.S. nuclear-powered submarine sank a Japanese fishing training boat last month, killing 9 people, including 4 high school students. This news from Moscow. Tired and defiant journalists at Russia's only independent nationwide television network stayed on the job all night after a takeover move widely seen as a Kremlin attempt to bring NTV to heel. The rebellion came after state-run gas giants Gazprom purged NTV of its leadership yesterday. Gazprom's media subsidiary teamed up with a small U.S.-based company to amass just over the 50% necessary to vote through the sweeping changes. NTV journalists canceled all entertainment programming beginning today in what they call an act of civil disobedience. Gazprom's move to take over NTV came as U.S. media mogul Ted Turner reportedly agreed in principle to purchase NTV founder Vladimir Gusinsky's shares in the network, although it would only be a minority share. Gazprom's representatives tried to justify the takeover in financial terms, saying the company had been hemorrhaging money and would never be able to make good on its loans. The network's outspoken journalists disdain pledges by their new director, a controversial American investment banker, not to meddle in editorial policy. An array of prominent politicians, including former Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev, denounced the takeover. This news from Toronto, Canada. Finance ministers from 34 Western Hemisphere nations gathered yesterday to discuss the slowing U.S. economy and other fiscal issues. Police braced for demonstrations outside the Midtown Hotel where the finance ministers were gathered. Barricades kept traffic a block away, and black uniformed police officers stood guard. The meeting precedes the April 20th to 22nd summit in Quebec City, where heads of state will discuss the creation of the Free Trade Area of the Americas Agreement, a trade zone that would stretch from Alaska to Patagonia. President Bush wants fast-track authority from Congress to proceed quickly on the agreement. However, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez said yesterday that his country sides with Brazil in wanting to strengthen the South American trade bloc Mercosur before starting the FTAA. an activist who hit Canada's Prime Minister Jean Chrétien in the face with a cream pie was convicted of assault yesterday. Evan Brown, who's 24, had a long list of grievances against the Canadian government, including a belief that Ottawa gives too much support to multinational corporations and institutions such as the International Monetary Fund and concerns about genetically modified food. Meanwhile, the woman who threw a tomato at British Prime Minister Tony Blair to protest British support for sanctions against Iraq was convicted of disorderly conduct. Lynn Marie Coles, who's 26, said, "I don't know what came over me." She said she grabbed a bag of tomatoes from another protester because she thought she was a better shot. The prosecutor said Coles apologized for the attack and admitted it had been somewhat misguided, but the arresting officer said Coles appeared happy to be apprehended. He said, quote, "She was shouting, 'Got him with veg, got him with a tomato.'" Set on Freedom, Vika and Linda from the CD Love from a Short Distance, compilation CD for the children of East Timor, here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In August of 1999, the overwhelming majority of East Timorese voted to end more than a quarter century of Indonesian occupation. From the time of its invasion in 1975, the Indonesian military killed more than a third of the population of Timor, more than 200,000 Timorese. Throughout, the Indonesian army was armed, financed, and trained by the United States. This right through the independence vote. As the Timorese went to the polls, the Indonesian military and its militias razed East Timor to the ground, thus turning the birth of the fledgling nation into a humanitarian disaster. The man who led the resistance from the mountains and eluded the military for more than 17 years was Xanana Gusmao. In November 1992, he was captured and imprisoned in Jakarta, the capital of Indonesia. His contact to smuggle out information was a young Australian woman who was working underground in Indonesia. Her nom de guerre was Ruby Blade. When Timorese took over foreign embassies in Jakarta to call attention to the genocide occurring in their country, Ruby Blade, her real name, Kirsty Sword, was their contact to the outside world and the media. When Xanana Gusmao was released from prison into a halfway house in 1999, Kirsty Sword worked with him in Indonesia. They married last summer, recently had a baby. And just this past March, Kirsty Sword Gusmao testified before the UN Human Rights Commission about violations that continue to this day against the people of East Timor. Although the independence vote took place August 30th, 1999, at the time, Indonesian militias and the Indonesian military were rampaging through Timor and drove more than half of the population of Timor out of their homes. Many of those people were driven into West Timor, which is a part of Indonesia. And it is believed today that roughly about 100,000 Timorese are still being held in the refugee camps in West Timor. Among the most vulnerable there are the women. Many of them have been raped and turned into sexual slaves of militiamen. Today, we're going to spend the hour speaking with Kirsty Sword Gusmao and Xanana Gusmao in an exclusive interview in their short trip here to the United States. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Kirsty Sword-Gushmau, let's start by talking with you about the plight of the women refugees. How extensive is this problem?
Well, as you mentioned, there are between 80 and 100,000 refugees still in West Timor. We guess that over half of those, or roughly half, are women. Their situation is very grave in that they have very little access to humanitarian agencies and the humanitarian support provided by those organisations, particularly since September last year when three international staff of the UNHCR were murdered in Atambua.
That's the UN High Commissioner on Refugees.
That's right, yeah. And as a result of that barbarous attack, the humanitarian agencies, not only UNHCR, but other organisations like the International Committee of the Red Cross, withdrew their activities from West Timor. So that has left the refugees, particularly women, who were already in a very vulnerable situation, in even more desperate circumstances now. They have little access to information, accurate information about what the situation inside East Timor is. Therefore, they're unable to make an informed decision as to whether to return to East Timor and to participate in the reconstruction of their newly freed homeland or whether to remain in West Timor.
In the UN Human Rights Commission, when you testified, you highlighted the case of Juliana dos Santos. Can you tell us her story?
Yeah, Juliana dos Santos is a young woman from Swai on the southern coast of East Timor. She was abducted by a notorious militia leader, Egidio Manik, at the age of 15, following a massacre in the Swai church complex, which was one of the most brutal massacres that happened in the post-ballot period. Up to 200 people were killed, including Juliana's younger brother, Carlos, who was 11 at the time.
This was right before the vote and the... Or right
it
after
was
the
immediately
vote.
After,
right
the, after vote, the vote, 2 days after the results of the ballot were announced publicly.
And the militia moved into a church compound and...
Yeah, basically the population of Swai, in a misguided belief that the church would offer them refuge, sought a safe haven from the violence inside the church complex. And what happened was the militia actually rounded up the people within the church complex and murdered virtually the entire male population or the male occupants of the church.
Including the priests.
That's right, including one very popular priest, Father Hilario.
And then what happened to Juliana?
To tell you sort of the whole story, basically the entire male occupants of the church complex were ordered to congregate in one area of the church complex. The women were told to lie face down on the floor. This included Juliana, her and her aunt and mother, who were also seeking refuge in the complex. The militia, apparently at the order of Egidio Manik, this particular militia leader, were then shot, and Juliana's brother was shot in the head.
How old was he?
He was 11. Then all of the female occupants of the church were ordered to leave, and as Juliana and her aunt left the building, Egidio Manik is said to have taken her by the shoulder and pronounced in front of everyone, "This is the one that I want to take as my wife." Juliana's aunt, who accompanied me to Geneva, to the Human Rights Commission, has told me about how she attempted to resist the abduction, but Egidio Manik fired a shot in the air, and sort of fearing for her own safety and that of Juliana, she released Juliana. She was then taken away, and the family didn't see her again for another few hours. Following on from that, the female occupants of the church complex were all taken to the local district military command headquarters, the CODIM. And according to people that were detained for the following week after the massacre, numerous cases of rape and other sort of sexual crimes were committed inside the headquarters of the military. Juliana's aunt, her own daughter, who was married with children, was also raped during this time. A couple of hours later, after the women were taken to the Kodim, Juliana was returned by Egidio Manek to the command base, and he pulled aside Juliana's mother and aunt, and in front of them is said to have taken off a gold chain from around his neck and placed it around Juliana's neck, stating, "Now she is officially my wife." She was then bundled back into a car and taken away, and the family never saw her again after this point. So the information that we have, which is very scant since her abduction, is that she's being held in a state of virtual sexual slavery by Egidio Manek, who incidentally has been accused not only of the murder of numerous people in Swai, but also numerous rapes as well of women, including many that have returned from West Timor in recent times. So Juliana's case is particularly horrific, not only because of the age at which she was taken to West Timor, but also because of these very brutal circumstances. Her family are understandably distraught and seriously emotionally scarred by this experience. They only had two children, so they're desperate to have Juliana returned to them. So it's kind of been at their request that I have taken on this campaign of trying to secure her release, but at the same time to draw attention to the broader problem of refugee women in East Timor who, as I mentioned before, are extremely vulnerable and who deserve to be given special treatment in the whole repatriation effort.
As women who were raped by Indonesian military or militia return home, how are they received in their communities in East Timor? And of course, this is not just an issue for Timor, but for refugees around the world and women victims of war.
Mm. There are cases reported of women being shunned by their communities and in some cases by their families upon return. So the reintegration process can be very difficult. This is due, of course, to an erroneous perception of what rape is about. There's a belief that in some way the woman brought this experience upon themselves. I mean, clearly in the case of Juliana, you know, she was a kidnapped woman. She had absolutely no say in what befell her. And I think her family, in Juliana's case, her family are very clear that she was a victim of a grave violation of her human rights. And so in this particular case, I don't think there's any question that she and the child that she has given birth to in November last year would be warmly received back in her community and in her family.
When you went to Australia recently, you called for these women who are returning to be called, not just to honor them, but to call them war heroes.
Yeah, this was a deliberate attempt to overturn these views that in some way women are responsible for what has happened to them, and also to, subvert this whole notion that women are victims merely of wartime situations and that they should be honoured. After all, the wars are very, very, in most cases, are not of their own making, and yet women and children represent, you know, the most victimised and most vulnerable groups in conflict situations.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Kirsty Sword Gushmau and Shanana Gushmau, I guess you could call you the first family of East Timor right now. But as the international attention turns away from East Timor after the vote for independence. The problems that Timor faces are extremely grave, although the promise is also tremendous. One of the last countries in the world to become a full nation. It will declare its full independence soon. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guests are Kirsty Sword Gushmao and Shanana Gushmao of East Timor. Kirsty Sword Gushmao, just having come from the UN Human Rights Commission in Geneva, where she brought the case of Juliano dos Santos to the attention of the world body. Juliana, a 15-year-old girl who was taken in one of the Indonesian militia massacres just after the independence vote of August 30th, 1999, taken by a militia leader now being held in West Timor. She's just given birth to a baby boy. She was raped by the militia leader. And she is one of, it's believed, more than 100,000 East Timorese refugees who remain in refugee camps in West Timor. The man who raped her, the man who is keeping her there now, is a well-known militia leader. What is the Indonesian military and government now saying about him? Will they arrest him?
Well, we believe that he was summoned by the Indonesian Attorney General to answer charges against him in September last year. However, he failed to show, and I don't believe there's been any follow-up either from the Indonesian civilian authorities or the military to actually drag him to Jakarta and eventually bring him to justice, which is hardly surprising given that the militias, of course, were a creation of the Indonesian military to begin with. And there's much evidence to suggest that this man continues to operate with the implicit blessing of the Indonesian military, if not civilian authorities, although I gather that there is, some degree of collaboration there.
Shanana Gushmao, why don't we take on this issue of the refugees, more than 100,000 in West Timor right now. What can you do as a leader of East Timor to have these people repatriated? The Indonesian government says they're there because they want to be there.
It is a difficult problem. We are trying to persuade all of these people to come back. But because of the fear of justice, not only the militias, but the UNTAS leader, UNTAS Pro-Autonomy Organization, they are still keeping people there, just a bargaining point because of the perspective of being trial, and it is a very difficult problem. Although they are coming, people are coming. Although we are incentivizing people to come and to see how the situation is in East Timor. They used to come and go and come and go. Unfortunately, when they go back to East Timor, they say, they inform all the bad, all the misinformation, and very, very difficult situation, and we are still hoping that the Indonesian government can take a strong measure in this case.
Let's go to the issue of war crimes. In the last week in the United States, in a Washington court, General Lumentang, Indonesian general, one of those responsible for the violence at the time of the referendum, was tried, although just civilly, not a criminal court, and he wasn't there. But Timorese victims came and testified about what happened under his reign. If he is found guilty by this U.S. magistrate, perhaps his assets will be seized if they're found in the United States. Some feel that these trials are significant but symbolic. But what about real war crimes tribunals for the Indonesian military? Where does that now stand, Shenana Gushmao?
I don't know. And we hope that the international community can do the job. You can understand we are in a very difficult phase, in a very difficult transition to independence. We know that we will face other difficulties in the first period of independence. And we believe that if the international community, following the example of the United States court about Lumentang, it will not only help us, East Timorese, but essentially to help the democratization in Indonesia, because I believe that the Indonesian society also is waiting for a chance of clarifying all the problems in the past.
The Indonesian government says they'll try people who they feel committed crimes, but they have yet to do this. Do you think an international war crimes tribunal should be set up?
It is a job of international community. We East Timorese and East Timor as a very small country, we cannot... be ambitious to be a model of justice, but we hope that the international community can do that. I believe that the DL project of searching all the genocide crimes in East Timor from 1975. Can give to the international community enough proof of the involvement of the certain generals. And now the international community is more looking at August and September 1999 events, but forget all the past from 75, from the invasion.
more than 200,000 Timorese were killed. You were leading the resistance in the mountains for many of the years of the occupation. For those who do not know, Xanana Gusmão was a Nelson Mandela-like figure for the Timorese, eluding the grasp of the Indonesian military for 17 years. In fact, when you were ultimately captured and arrested and held in the Tsipanang prison in Jakarta, Nelson Mandela did come to see you. At this point, though, here in East Timor, since Timor doesn't get a lot of attention now in the mainstream media, though it is getting attention, of course, in Australia and Portugal, which was the former colonizing power of Timor, people may not know that you recently resigned as head of the National Council, which is the transitional council in East Timor, while the United Nations is in control leading up to the independence of Timor and elections. I wanted to ask you about why you resigned as head of the National Council. It has caused quite an uproar in East Timor, where you'll be returning in the next few days.
It is just not only to prove that I'm not Nelson Mandela, but essentially the situation now in East Timor needs that the political parties can be more active in their responsibilities. We are working for them to compete in the power. We, in the plan, in our calendars, they will start campaigning in the middle of June. And I feel myself a little like a shadow for people, for other leaders that want to come up for the political parties.
And you're saying you feel that they are kept in your shadow?
Yeah, and it is negative for our process. You know, we are not South Africa. We are a former colony. We never lived in democratic institutions. And what we need is that the people start to gain self-confidence. This way, resigning by resigning as National Council Speaker, it doesn't mean that the National Council will not work. All the political process already has the legal basis, and now they are working only in the implementation of the of all that we already decided. We do that. This is why I believe that it is the right time to start withdrawing myself and giving the opportunity to other people.
Many people believe you will be the first president of a free and independent East Timor, which goes to the issue of, is a freedom fighter the best leader of a country? After you resigned, José Ramos Horta, who has often been heard on our air, Nobel Peace Prize winner, also now on the National Council, said, if everyone resigns every time a bill is rejected, then democracies will be in trouble. He said, this is just growing pains. Xanana was terrific as a guerrilla leader in the bush. Every time he decided to ambush the Indonesian units, there was no vote on it. He said, I remain personally persuaded we will persuade Xanana to change his mind. Will you change your mind?
No. No, because it is a principle for me. I don't see that it is automatically necessary that a leader in the struggle could be the president, could be the leader in the independence stage. a little that I already did. And I would like to clarify a question. We came from a destruction. Many, many people are now asking for something like compensation of the struggle. People come to me and say, what about me? I also fought. I also suffered. And in the independence, we will need two things. One, the continuous support from the international community, and another, stability to respond to this support. Stability we can define in two fields. One, political stability, and another, I cannot say social stability, but I would like to say social instability that we face now and we will face more in the first period of independence. About political stability, I believe that the political parties already are aware of the importance of not doing any mistakes because of the international community. The international community will watch every steps of the political, and they are aware of this. What we will face in a very, very strong way is the social instability. And I believe that inside the system, I will not help very much the people to understand the difficulties of the government to solve all the problems. And but outside, I can help them. I can help them understand, and trust the democratic institutions, because we never experienced a democratic institution. We are facing new things. We have to change the mentality. It is very crucial for us. And if I am inside the system, they will come to me. I told you before that I feel being a shadow for political parties, for other leaders, and they will complain to me, and I will not be able to solve the problems. Outside I can help. I can help the process. Outside I can help changing the mentality of our people. It is a very difficult task, but
changing the mentality from what to what?
Firstly, for the past of not trusting justice, not trusting in the government, in any institutions, and we are in the process of building these democratic institutions. Secondly, the mentality of asking for not privilege, asking for compensation for what they did in the struggle. All people, it is because of the destruction. People are willing to rebuild their life, and there are many expectations, and it will be many, many frustrations.
Do you think the Indonesian government should pay reparations to the people of Timor for the destruction?
I don't believe so. I don't believe they are in a very difficult economic situation. And we already stated in Jakarta in November 1999 that we will not ask for any compensation or reparation. Yeah.
Will you run for president of East Timor?
No, I am telling you that no.
Well, you've said no before, but the people of East Timor don't accept that.
I will campaign for not running. Yes.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves, but we will return to this conversation with Xanana Gusmão, the leader of East Timor, however unwilling, and Kirsty Sword Gusmão, resistance activist herself from Australia, married Xanana Gusmão last year, now campaigning for the women refugees who are being held in West Timor. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You are listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio and our exclusive interview with Xanana Gusmão, leader of East Timor, and Kirsty Sword Gusmão, who is an underground resistance activist herself in Indonesia, originally from Australia, now living in East Timor with her husband Xanana Gusmão and their new baby. We are talking about whether you would run for president. You deny that at this point. Also, for clarification, since we're getting different information over the newswire, you quit Xanana Gusmão as head of the National Council, but not as president of CNRT, the National Council of Timorese Resistance. Is that right? The umbrella group?
Yes. There are different bodies. CNRT is an umbrella organization in the struggle. I'm still the president of CNRT until the 1st of June, next June, when we will dissolve CNRT.
When you will dissolve CNRT?
Yes. The National Council is a very provisional body, legislative body in UNDAET, linked with UNDAET.
UNDAET being the United Nations transitional government of East Timor.
Yes, different bodies.
For some background, Kirsty Sword Gusmão, how you came to be involved with East Timor and what your role was in Indonesia. I think it's very interesting as young grassroots activists listen to this program. What is the mechanism a country goes through like this, under occupation for 25 years, third of the population killed, one of the worst genocides of the 20th century, and how the Indonesian government was ultimately toppled, how the occupation was ended. What role did you play? You were a foreigner. You were from Australia. How did you get involved with Timor?
Basically, through my language studies, I studied Indonesian both at high school and majored in Indonesian at university. And sort of through my studies and a number of trips to Indonesia, I came to know about the less savoury side of life, if you like, in Indonesia, the, you know, lack of democracy, the oppression, human rights violations, you know, rampant across the country. And through, you know, coming to be aware of the situation in Indonesia. I also gained some knowledge of what was happening very much behind the scenes in East Timor. I travelled there in 1991 with the Yorkshire Television documentary filmmaking team, which filmed the Santa Cruz massacre. And
where more than 250 Timorese were killed.
That's right. And basically, that sort of was a catalyst for me, that experience of making the film, and again, having it brought home to me the determination of the East Timorese to fight for their right to self-determination. I decided sort of there and then that I really wanted to commit more of my time and my energy to assisting them to achieve their goal. So I moved to Jakarta in 1992 without a job, without really a very clear idea of what I was going to do, but just with a very clear idea that I wanted to help East Timor in some way. So I got work as an English teacher, and that managed to sort of pay the bills and keep me alive while I did things which I was sort of more committed to.
And what did you do exactly?
Well, I had a lot of friends, East Timorese students, who kind of made use of me, I suppose, as a bit of a channel, a bit of a bridge to the outside world. I had access to email, which back in, you know, sort of the early 90s was still fairly uncommon. I had also encryption programs, which meant that I could encrypt my mail so that it was entirely safe. So I was, I guess, a bit of a courier, a bit of a voice for them. In getting the message across about what they were suffering, the kinds of persecution which they, as pro-independent students, were experiencing in Java.
Something that certainly shook the Indonesian regime was when Timorese students moved into embassies, foreign embassies. You were part of that. Can you explain what happened? This was when,
1993 was sort of the first asylum request. I assisted a group of about seven East Timorese to enter the Finnish and the Swedish embassies in Jakarta. They were young people who were on the run from the Indonesian authorities and had a very real, were facing sort of a very real threat of persecution. And so I, before we kind of sent them on their way into the embassies, I sort of gathered biographical data about each one, took photographs so that we could, you know, release this information to the media, so that, as well as, you know, providing safety and a safe passage out of the country for these Timorese, we could also use the opportunity to draw attention to the situation in East Timor and the situation of young East Timorese living in Java.
And these students got into these embassies, and they ultimately, a number of them, did get safe passage to different countries.
That's right, mainly to Portugal, which immediately offered to take them.
And you also became a conduit of information back and forth to Xanana Gusmão, who was in prison at the time, at the Tsipanang prison, with other political prisoners.
Yeah, I knew one of the other political prisoners being detained in Tsipanang prison, João Freitas da Câmara, before he was arrested for demonstrating peacefully on the streets of Jakarta a week after the Santa Cruz massacre. And I was corresponding with him, also providing support from Amnesty International for himself and also other political prisoners being detained throughout Indonesia. And so through that route, yeah, I came to communicate also with Xanana, and after some time sort of became something of a private secretary.
And then in 1999, Xanana Gusmão, you were let out of jail, though you did a lot of organizing when you were in prison, organizing of the resistance outside, and even managed to have a cell phone and communicate with people outside. Now the country is moving towards independence. When will elections be held? Now run by the United Nations, the Timor is, but soon there will be elections for an assembly that will write a constitution?
Yes. The plan is that in 3rd of August will be the election from the Constituent Assembly, maybe technical reasons, difficulties, I don't know. We all in East Timor, UNTET and East Timorese, we are doing our best just to accomplish the date. It doesn't mean that we will expel UNTET from East Timor. It will be the turning point for the mandate of UNTET. We understand that the transition means capacity building, the mandate of UNDET. It is why if we have elected body in the legislative field, we will build their capacity. We will build the capacity for the right persons, and in the executive also. Until May, we will discuss and define an ideal structure for our government, and it is after the elections we will have some structure.
What about the concern that the United Nations transitional government in East Timor, the transitional administration, is not including consulting with the Timorese in the governing of Timor?
They are consulting in some way. The National Council is a consultative body of but what we want to push in a more effective way is the recruitment, the Timorization, a word that I don't accept, but the Timorization, the recruitment of Timorese. After the election, with a definition of an ideal structure of the government to the independence, we hope that the recruitment of levels below the ministries will be more effectively recruited.
Now you have UN personnel in East Timor paid something like $300 a day to do their work, and there are thousands of them, $300 a day, which is an enormous US dollars sum for Timorese. Yet Timorese who work for the UN are paid something like $5 a day or $10 a day. Why this enormous disparity?
I think that we have to recognize that it is the first mission like this for the United Nations. But on the other hand, it is a mission of the United Nations. And it is why we put our efforts in the elections, because after the elections, we believe that we can start reducing the international staff, and we can identify areas in which we will still need international experts, in areas in which we already are ready to take over, and in other areas in which we will need only advisors, international advisors, just to reduce more and more the big big staff of.
In talking about international advisors and experts, what about the World Bank and the IMF? Clearly, moving into East Timor, how do you protect the people of East Timor from what has happened in other countries with the World Bank and the IMF, the marginalization of people, the issue of privatization?
I have to say that we are in a learning situation. Of course, what we know about World Bank and IMF will help us to what can I say? Will help us to know how to deal with the international economic, financial institutions, because it is all new for us, and what we hope is that East Timorese, our politicians, our techniques, can start learning in this process.
And to clarify, you have quit as head of the National Council. Are you still a member of the National Council as president of the CNRT? You've quit as the head of the National Council.
Yes.
Set up by the United Nations.
Member and the Speaker of the National Council.
You have you quit as a member?
And Speaker of the National Council.
And Speaker.
Council.
But you've not quit as president of the umbrella group,
it
the
is
National Council.
Very different.
Timorese Resistance.
Yes.
Kirsty Sword Gushmao, you've moved from being an underground resistance activist to having the national spotlight on you in a more traditional role as wife of the Timorese leader. You can bring attention to issues like Juliana dos Santos, but do you feel limited in your role as a wife? I mean, are there things you cannot say? You've so long been an independent activist.
I don't feel any real restrictions on what I can or cannot say. Certainly, there are none imposed by Shinani himself or by other Timorese. I think, obviously, in raising the issue of Juliana dos Santos, I've come out and strongly criticised the Indonesian government and military for their failure to take earlier action to resolve her case, which could, I suppose, potentially have ramifications for the political strategy of the East Timorese to, reconcile, if you like, with the Indonesian government. But I think, my declarations and my statements are taken as those of a private individual who is concerned about particular issues. And so I don't think, it's taken as a reflection of political policy on the part of the East Timorese leadership.
If people want to get in touch with you or with the foundation you're setting up to deal with women refugees, victims of war, rape victims, etc., rape survivors, can they send you email?
Yeah, I would be very happy to provide further information about the situation of women refugees, or also to provide information about how people can help if they are interested in doing so. The email address is Shanana, Xanana, at minihub, MINIHUB.org.
And that information will be at our website at webactive.com. I want to thank you both for being with us, Kirsty Sword Gushmao and Shanana Gushmao, the leader of East Timor. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Terry Allen and Chris Abrams. Anthony Sloan is our engineer. Errol Maitland, our technical director. You can write to us at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of you, our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Think about the masons who laid the first layer of the Great Wall of China, or those cathedrals.